I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. New Hampshire is the tryout town of American politics that became a make-or-break main event. On February 1st this year, 4 weeks from yesterday, the New Hampshire primary is still the first open ballot test of the presidential candidates in either party. But it's different this year. No home court advantages to speak of. No ideological warfare, but some nice symmetry in the Republican and the Democratic choices. Prohibitive favorites George Bush in one party and Al Gore in the other have been humbled already by resourceful challengers John McCain and Bill Bradley, humbled also by New Hampshire's famous inclination to get up close and kick the tires of all candidates indiscriminately. So we're down to less than a month of two tight battles among centrist professionals going all out. Connection listeners, is this American politics at its blandest, perhaps, or just possibly American politics at its best? The Bigfoot political reporter of the New York Times, Rick Burke, is our guest by phone. The editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in New Hampshire, Guy McMillan, is on the line. Former New Jersey Senator Bill Bradley will check in from the road in New Hampshire. Connection listeners, especially in New Hampshire, have you met George Bush seven times yet? Have you had coffee four times already with Bill Bradley? What's the real resemblance in New Hampshire to the storybook image of a local anvil of a national democracy? Make the New Hampshire primary connection at 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. Rick Burke,
Chris,
the New York Times, good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Do we have a storyline? Do we have a narrative of this new New Hampshire primary yet?
Well, of course, you say bland, perhaps, but I think it's one of the most exciting situations up in New Hampshire we've seen in decades, really, when you think about it, when you think it could go either way in either party. I mean, we don't know if any of the four guys are going to come up, who's going to come up on top. So I think it's going to be a great concentrated 3 or 4 weeks.
No, I'm wide open to that. It's going to be, it's all out. It's talented. These are professionals. This is the real thing. There'll be no sort of sneak surprises. There may be some surprises.
There might be. You never know. But it'd be hard to see who. You never know. Steve Forbes or someone, you know, I'm open to anything.
Well, but there's a good example. Steve Forbes seemed a bigger deal 4 years ago than this year with his tax notions. I mean, is that even on the boards this year?
Well, he's putting more effort into Iowa, where I mean I think there's a better chance that he could sneak up on the others in the Republican Party. But for whatever reason, I think people are just sick of him after 4 years ago. I have heard his appeal and his pitch, and just think that's old news. And I think he's had a problem all along, and that people don't see him as presidential because he's never been elected to anything, and they still see him even in focus groups as sort of this rich guy who, and I've seen Forbes' focus groups, they let me see them, and time and time again people say, and I hate to say this, but they say he's just not physically appealing, and they don't see him as being president. I think that hurts them.
Well, let's assume that he's not going to make it. Let's assume we're talking about four corners of a two-party race here.
Right.
What's the New Hampshire angle for George Bush? John McCain either, for Bill Bradley, for Al Gore. I mean, what's at stake here?
Well, I think, first of all, for Bill Bradley and for John McCain, there's a lot of pressure for them to now win in New Hampshire because particularly John McCain has staked his whole effort in New Hampshire. He's essentially run a one-state race in New Hampshire. Bill Bradley has also concentrated a lot of effort in New Hampshire. That's the state where they both come on strong. And if they don't do well there, then it's hard to see, or if they don't win there, it's going to be hard for them to go on. I mean, I think they'd still try to go on, but there's a lot at stake for them there.
Why should New Hampshire like John McCain?
He's a combative personality. He's not, New Hampshire normally voters often don't like sort of the anointed party guy. They like something different. They like a scrappy insurgent. I mean, Pat Buchanan won last time. And I think they seem to like his campaign reform message. And I also think the reality is that George Bush treated New Hampshire as he did any other state. He didn't particularly go there that much in last year. He didn't do as much of the retail campaigning as a lot of New Hampshireites expect. You expect them, you know, you said at the top of the show, you know, seven times, have they met him seven times? A lot of New Hampshire voters haven't met George Bush, but they've met John McCain again and again and again, partly because he's had the luxury of focusing on one state where Bush has run a national campaign. But New Hampshire, you know, voters, they may be spoiled, but they're not very forgiving, and they expect their candidates to be there. And
they treated his father like a halfway neighbor. Does that rub off? Should it?
I think that's helped him all along and giving him some instant credibility as coming from a good family, that, I mean, from knowing politics. I think if George Bush came out of nowhere and no one had heard of him, George Brown or something, it wouldn't have been the same. He wouldn't be where he is.
Al Gore inherits a kind of unhappy New Hampshire role. He's sort of the Lyndon Johnson, Ed Muskie, Walter Mondale party favorite. New Hampshire's been rude to those kinds of players in the past.
Right. And I think Bradley benefits in the same way McCain benefits, is there's sort of a different alternative fresh face, relatively speaking, someone who's pushing the reform line, whether or not they're true outsiders. I mean, I would argue that they're not, but they're portraying themselves, both Bradley and McCain, as outsiders. New Hampshire likes that. They don't like the sort of, as I said, they don't want someone coming in who's already crowned the nominee.
Rick Burke, stand by, would you? Guy McMillan's
sure.
On the line, runs the editorial page of the Keene Sentinel in southwest New Hampshire. Guy McMillan, you know, New Hampshire, we love to think of it as the last outpost of retail politics against big money. Of course, it's a big money primary, but how much of the sort of coffee shop living room politics still prevails there?
Well, you know, I think everything that's ever been said about the New Hampshire primary is probably true, to one extent or another. There is a certain group here in New Hampshire, a large group of people who take this responsibility or whatever it is very seriously, and they go out and they listen to the candidates and they talk about it and they vote on primary day. And then there's another group, and I think it's much larger, that gets a lot of its information from 30-second television commercials, just like people do in other states. So it's a mixture. You can focus on one end of it or the other, but it all comes together on the 1st of February.
Who's good among the candidates you're watching at the sort of at least seven coffees kind of politics?
Well, if we stick to the four people that you kind of singled out, and I guess I would, certainly Gore and Bradley and McCain have been doing a lot of that, and they are fast on their feet. I sat through a 2.5-hour session where Al Gore went out to the Keene High School here a couple of Sundays ago, and he answered questions until the audience was exhausted, you know, and he was still going. And he said, "I'll stay here for the last person." It was quite an impressive showing. McCain has been doing this all along in colleges and town halls. Bradley's been doing it to some extent lately. And George W. Bush is not. I mean, when he came to Keene, he went to the mall. He didn't come to the newspaper for an interview or to the radio stations for an interview or to the college for a Q&A. He went to the mall and shook hands.
I watched George McGovern in 72 go parlor to parlor, basically, all through Manchester, Concord, Laconia. I mean, do people do parlor politics still?
Yeah, they do, but they try to set it up so that there are some cameras there and some extension of it. Al Gore was in a local lawyer's home here a few months ago, and he went outside and played football or something with a bunch of kids, and there was a photo op. It's not exactly what it's billed as. It's more of a kind of a you know, something that will get, they'll make the news either in the newspaper or on television.
Guy McMillan, Bill Bradley is on the line. Senator Bradley, welcome back to The Connection.
Chris, great to be back with you.
No rote answers here. I want to know what a candidate learns from sort of local politics in a national campaign. What does one hear that one doesn't hear in a TV studio?
Well, you hear the stories that the people tell you. I mean, that's the flesh and blood of politics. That's what keeps you going out there. And only when you have contact with people and listen to them do you actually get that kind of richness. So
Guy McMillan just said you and Bill and Al Gore are both very, very good at it. I want to know what surprises you when you get out of the beltway and have a chance to listen.
Well, what surprises me is absolutely the goodness of the American people, quite frankly. What surprises me is their basic optimism, their absence of complaining. their belief that somehow or another we're going to not only do well, but we're going to excel. I mean, that continues to strike me. I mean, you know, I was in a Head Start center not so long ago here in New Hampshire, and I was there to focus on the women who were the teachers, because I tried to at various stops shine the light on people who are excelling in their communities every day that no one ever hears of. And as I was leaving, I walked into the kitchen. There were two women in there. One woman had worked in a restaurant. The other woman had been a mother at home before they took a job in this Head Start center. And I asked them, do you like your job? And one of the women said, oh, I love my job. She says, where else can you come to work every day and have five kids hug you and say they love you? Mm-hmm. Well, and that's a very nice moment. That says, you know, of all the things in her life, material possessions aren't as important as the love of those kids and the smile of those kids.
What can Washington do for that woman other than get out of her way?
Well, one of the things we can do is, for example, to double the amount of funds available for Head Start, which is actually something that I've proposed to do, so that that center can be better, so that it can employ more people who will have that experience.
You know, people have noted, Senator Bradley, that there's a bit of the Jimmy Carter campaign about yours nowadays. In a certain sense, flatter the people about their goodness, which may indeed be holding up a right mirror to them, too. But also, run against Washington. What are the limits to this kind of campaign?
Well, I think that what I'm trying to do is go out and tell people who I am and where I'm from and what I want to do, and define it in a way that they will give me their trust. And to me, the important thing is just being who you are and not giving something that people can vote for as opposed to voting against. I mean, negative politics is the way politics is always practiced. It is, in a way, what's turned people off about politics. And attacks are easy. It takes discipline not to attack. And so what I'm trying to do in this campaign is speak to where people are living their lives in terms of making sure that they have access to affordable quality health care and that middle-income people have more resources to pay for that. In addition to emphasizing the absolute need for campaign finance reform, which is the linchpin to virtually everything else that we might want to do in Washington, and telling the people themselves that they can be instrumental in us overcoming the special interests that are in Washington. I mean, it's not running against Washington. I've been there 18 years to point out that the special interests are in control by and large. And the only way that you overcome that is with the mandate that the people give you to do certain specific things. And that's why I've laid out very specific programs on health care, on campaign finance reform, on registration and licensing of all handguns, and on programs that would eliminate child poverty. And
what do people respond to? I mean, a politician is always sort of testing lines, testing attention.
I think that people respond to you answering their question directly. That's why dialogue is so important. They respond to candor. They respond to someone's genuine expression of their own life experience in the context of the problems or the hopes that they might be expressing to you.
Let me ask you, there's so much contentment in the country these days. People get scared about it. I mean, between the Dow Jones average, crime rates down, unemployment rates down. We're in a very, not just fat and happy, but a happy moment in this country. How does a candidate treat this, and how will the Democrats in the year at large sort of use this happiness to their advantage?
Well, Chris, what I think is that there's no question we're at a period of unprecedented prosperity driven by technology and by globalization. And the real question is now, what do we do with this tremendous prosperity? And my opinion is that, you know, the time to fix the roof is when the sun is shining. The sun is shining now. And that means now is the time to dramatically increase the number of Americans with health insurance, decrease the number of children who live in poverty, and help working families who have not been on that train of prosperity be able to get on. And I think if we did that as well as make major efforts to heal the racial divide in this country, that you would have a stronger foundation for all future economic growth. If we can't do these things now in these good times, when can we do them?
Are there any real differences, Senator Bradley, between what you and Al Gore would do about these things?
Yes, I think there are. In terms of health care, the health care system is in distress. It's not only the 44 million who don't have any health insurance, but a lot of people with insurance doubt they're going to get to see the doctor in time or get into the hospital they want. And millions of middle-class people are paying way too much for health care. Doctors have lost the joy of practicing medicine. Nurses are unappreciated. Hospitals are under the hammer, having to do with less and less. And I think when you have this kind of distress in a healthcare system, you need a big solution. I've offered a big solution. The vice president has been nibbling around the edges of the issue. And I think that's a significant difference, just as I think we have a different willingness to take on the NRA. I mean, I've laid out a very specific program to register and license all 65 million handguns in America. To try to get rid of the devastation that takes place on in our country. 13 kids are killed every day. 800,000 kids took a gun to school last year. And I think if we don't have registration and licensing, we're not going to be able to track those guns and prevent them from getting in the hands of kids or getting in the hands of people who buy from shill dealers. So I think that's another real difference between us. And I've said up front that campaign finance reform is the key to everything, and I've emphasized that everywhere I've gone. I don't think that he hasn't supported registration and licensing, and while he supports campaign finance reform, he doesn't speak about it, and I think with the same kind of intensity and commitment.
Senator Bradley, catch your breath for a moment. I want to hear from Guy McMillan whether New Hampshire voters feel those differences between Bill Bradley and Al Gore.
I think they feel differences between the two candidates. If I can go back to my division of the electorate between the group that goes out and goes to the Q&A sessions and the group that stays home and watches the 30-second television ads, I think the group that goes out and asks the questions and that meets the candidates face-to-face begin to discern differences, perhaps more in terms of personality and temperament than in terms of policy details. I think people, if a candidate is in favor of some sort of health care reform that seems to be progressive, they may the voter may not exactly sit down with a comparative chart and try to figure out exactly which plan they like best, because I think they know that whatever plan gets whatever candidate gets elected, the plan goes through Congress. It has to fight with the special interests, and it may not come out, identical to what the candidate is saying on the trail right now. But I think the differences tend to be in terms of perception of the candidate's intensity and sincerity, and it's a face-to-face sort of thing.
Rick Burke, I wondered, you look at the big picture. How does New Hampshire serve as a place to sort of get to the point of American politics? Are we doing all right?
I think the fact that there is such a discussion of the issues in New Hampshire, I think that all is a good thing. I think that the debates have been useful and substantive. I think Guy is right when he says, in terms of Senator Bradley and Vice President Gore, there's, when you talk to voters in New Hampshire, they don't say, oh, I'm voting for Bradley because of his health care plan, as much as they say they talk about personality and styles and the differences, not as much about specific policy.
What's the choice here in, height, weight, wardrobe, moods?
Well, let me just jump in here for a second and say I don't exactly, I hope anyway, that it's not height, weight, and wardrobe. I do think they look to see if the candidate has a health care plan. If the candidate seems as worried as the people of New Hampshire are about the status of the health care system and health insurance, we've got a lot of HMOs bite the dust up here in the last year or so. What I'm saying is they don't go down and try to figure out the details. I think these two plans, with all deference to Senator Bradley, who's on the phone here, I got to be careful. I think both plans are sort of indecipherable for the moment in terms of their scope and nature. You just look at you say, it's a plan, and its heart is in the right place.
Senator Bradley, I want to ask you, what does a candidate learn watching the other league? I mean, what are you learning from watching John McCain and George Bush?
I don't watch it very much.
Oh, frankly, come on.
I'm on my own road here trying to talk to the people of New Hampshire. I mean, I read the newspaper occasionally about their campaigns. I think that there is a little bit of a comparison between John McCain and I in terms of us being insurgents and dedicated to campaign finance reform. And I think that our joint appearance in Claremont a short time ago was an example of putting national interest over partisan interest or even over self-interest. And I think that that registered with people. In terms of the last commentator making the point that there was no difference in scope, professors at Harvard and Stanford did an analysis of coverage and said that Al's program would cover 7 million people and mine would cover 30 million people. To the 23 million people that will have health coverage because of the program that I offer, it makes a difference, and I think they begin to see that. But I tend to agree with what people say, what the commentators have said here today, in terms of the basic decision that people make. I think they make a decision based upon who they want to lead the country as much as on a specific proposal. And I think that there are a lot of mysterious ingredients that go into that decision. I think that ultimately it comes down to a question of who they trust with their life and who they trust with their job and who they trust have a view of life that's remotely similar to their own. And so I think that and how that decision is ultimately made is not as scientific as a lot of the political scientists and political consultants would have you believe. It's a very mysterious ingredient in our democracy, and for president, it's the most intimate decision they can make. And when we begin to over-intellectualize it, I think we miss what is really the genius of our democracy.
Senator Rowdy, you say you don't watch the other race that carefully. People who watch them both say you're both up against a kind of apathy, and the first thing you've got to do is to get people interested to vote at all. Do you see it that way?
I think to a certain extent you're right, and I think that that's because there have been a lot of forces that have turned people off in the last couple of years. People don't feel that politics is going to speak to them where they live their lives. They're depressed about the control of big money in the process. They're turned off by the fierce partisanship and meanness of not only campaigns, but the whole Washington scene in the last couple of years. And I think that all depresses their kind of propensity to believe that things can be different. And, people have a right to be skeptical. But I also have a right to challenge that skepticism, and that's what I'm trying to do in the campaign, not only in terms of the substance, but also in terms of how I'm conducting the campaign. Mm-hmm. It's easy to be against something. It's hard to be for something, but I'm doing my best in running this race to give people something to vote for, because I think that in doing that, it's part of an antidote to the current disillusionment with our politics.
Senator Bradley, stand by. The connection phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK with Senator Bill Bradley, Rick Burke of the New York Times, Guy McMillan of the Keene Sentinel. Laura is on the line.
Hi, Senator.
Welcome, Laura.
Bradley, and hi. I guess what I'm a little, concerned or confused about is how you and Senator McCain, who spent as much of your lives inside the Beltway as anyone, and who seem to be involved in the same money race as all the other candidates, can represent yourselves as people who will reform campaign finances, mm-hmm. and won't be beholden to special interests, and will have a new approach when you've both been senators for a very long time, and everyone's
sure.
lived part of their lives outside the Beltway.
Sure.
And I would also like to ask if the journalists could possibly address whether Senators McCain and Bradley raise their money a different way from the other candidates, and if it's a more clean way, because that I haven't seen enough discussion of. Thank you.
Bill Bradley, take a crack at it,
yeah,
and Rick Burke, stand by.
First of all, I try to hold myself to a standard higher than existing law. I don't take PAC contributions. I don't set up sham state PACs in places like Virginia where people can give me $100,000 each and then I put $1 million on TV in New Hampshire. So I try to hold myself to a higher standard than existing law. John McCain and I shook hands in Claremont a few weeks ago, and we stated if we were the nominees of our party that we would not accept soft money for the presidential campaign. That is the first time a Democrat and a Republican stood together and said that. And indeed, that doesn't require Congress to do anything. That is a decision taken by the candidates themselves. And I think that's an important difference. In terms of the raising of money, we've raised more money over the Internet than anybody in history. In the last quarter, we had over 45,000 contributors to our campaign. The average contribution was about $200. And the reason we're successful in raising money is because people who've not been involved in politics before, not the
Senator Bradley, forgive me, I've got to
contributing to our campaign.
I've got to interrupt you just to say thank you for joining us in the first half of the Connection.
Great.
We'll be back after the break. Thank you, Senator
too.
Bradley. This is the Connection from WBUR Boston. We're funded by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by the construction site Blocks and Building Toys for Girls and Boys Aged Infant to Infinity. Toys with connections that snap, stack, screw, and slide together at constructiontoys.com. And by Magic Hour Communications, helping Fortune 1000 and fast-growing companies sell, market, and educate through videos, multimedia, websites, and presentations. Magic-hour.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the New Hampshire Primary Connection. The phone's 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, especially in New Hampshire, have you seen these candidates up close and personal? And is New Hampshire still a kind of safety valve against the politics of television and big money? 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the first in the nation ballot test of the major presidential candidates, with Rick Burke of the New York Times, Guy McMillan of the Keene Sentinel, and David Broder of the Washington Post. Far and away the wisest of the old boys on the bus. David Broder, you were there in 1492 for the New Hampshire primary, as I remember.
1942. You got the numbers
right. details. What are you seeing, David? I mean, you've seen virtually all of them in modern times. What are you seeing this year? What's New Hampshire going to decide for us?
I think New Hampshire will once again decide which candidates are most credible to those who have had the maximum exposure to them. Doesn't mean that the rest of the country, which depends much more on TV ads and images, will make the same judgment. But the New Hampshire magic is still working, Chris. I was out yesterday with John McCain. And as you know, he's spending most of his time in these town meetings answering voters' questions. And I'll give you just one example. A woman yesterday said to him, I hear the politicians talking about single mothers and one-parent families, and they always speak rather disparagingly, as if that was a terrible problem for the country to overcome. She said, I was raised by a single mother, and my younger sister has just finished college. I'm working here at this company. I think it's time that you gave some credit to the single mothers. And McCain said, that's a very good point, and I've been focusing on what we ought to be doing in terms of child care and other benefits to help women in that situation. But I'm going to try to make a point of saying my hat is off to those who are coping and coping well with the burdens of raising a family without a partner.
David Broder, I'm very glad to hear you say the New Hampshire magic is still working and that somebody like John McCain knows how to tap it.
It's a way of educating candidates, not just of educating voters.
Part of the magic is that the word spreads among New Hampshire people. This is our kind of guy, straight talking, decent listener, small D Democrat, town meeting sort of person.
That's right.
I mean, is that part of the magic?
Oh, of course, because what the candidates here try to do is to tap into networks of friends and associates. But there is one technological change this time. Bill Gardner, who, as you know, Chris, has been the Secretary of State up here for almost as long as I've been covering primaries up here, told me that he was at a class at St. Anselm's, the very good liberal arts college outside of Manchester, a few weeks ago, a class on the New Hampshire primary. And he said, I asked the students, for my own curiosity, to tell me how they get their information about the candidates. He said, put aside the conversations you have with your friends and tell me how many of you rely mainly on newspapers, television, radio, and the internet. And he said, television, 4 hands went up. Newspapers, 2 hands went up. Radio, I'm sorry to say, no hands went up. The rest of the class all raised their hands saying that they get their information from the internet. So that's certainly different.
Wow.
And the comment that...
They're listening to us on the internet, David.
Hmm?
They're listening to us on the internet.
That's good.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Guy McMillan of the Keene Sentinel was just saying that all of these major contenders this year are good at this game, except George Bush. What was left out of his sort of home training here, and is it going to cost him?
Are you talking to me again?
Well, I wanted to ask David Broder about your point, Guy.
All right.
I think Bush is very good at one traditional aspect of New Hampshire campaigning, from what I've seen. When he walks into a room and just has conversations with people one-on-one, he's almost at the Bill Clinton level of being able to focus on that one person and make that person feel as if, for that moment at least, he has the candidate's full attention and respect. That's a wonderful trait that he has. But he's not as comfortable, and I think Guy is right about this, in just sort of winging it in a question and answer period in the way that that most of the other candidates can do.
You just heard Bill Bradley sort of doing his thing with us and the people in New Hampshire, too. What has he learned about New Hampshire politics?
Well, Bradley, you know, likes to say that this is his second winter in New Hampshire, and the fact that he was up here so early and dealing with folks literally a living room at a time has now made it possible for him to be very comfortable dealing with the larger crowds that are turning out for his events now. I think he's become, if he wasn't already, a very good New Hampshire type of candidate.
And how about Al Gore, who, as we say, has sort of fallen into a bit of the heavy role, the Muskie, Mondale, almost Lyndon establishment guy?
Well, we've had 2 campaigns by Gore up here. First was when Vice President Gore was running as the officially endorsed and blessed candidate to succeed President Clinton. And then he was riding around in a big entourage with lots of security and so on. He found that that did not go over very well in New Hampshire. He's now campaigning very much as Al Gore, your willing, friendly neighbor, begging for your support, not commanding you to give it to him.
Our phone is 1-800-423-8255, or 1-800-423-TALK, the New Hampshire primary connection. Especially interested in connection listeners in New Hampshire who are having the experience, either as TV watchers, better yet, as year-round volunteers. 1-800-423-8255. David Broder, you've seen this game in many, many cycles. As I was saying earlier, it seems to me the 3 real marks of the New Hampshire primary are missing this year. We don't have a New England candidate. We don't have an ideological argument. And we don't really have the chance of a Pat Buchanan, Bob Dole sort of upset. In a way, that upset has already been scored by the outsider guys who have made it very, very close. We're just sort of down to the wire with basically very well-qualified candidates fighting in the center of both parties. How well does New Hampshire serve still as a kind of out-of-the-way, remote, almost all-white, upper-middle-class or middle-class, very marginal sort of state? I mean, is it a good device still?
I think it's a very good device. New Hampshire is not the same state that it was when you and I started covering primaries up here. It's now become very much a high-tech state, and in that sense, it probably is a bit of a forerunner of where the country is as a whole is going. But what hasn't changed is that the voters up here are extraordinarily conscientious and very much aware of the power that their first-in-the-nation primary gives them. I was talking yesterday with Tom Rath, who, as you know, was the attorney general up here, a Republican. And Tom said, you know, you don't have to worry about turning out the vote in New Hampshire. People here understand this is the most important vote that they will cast all year, because in the general election, New Hampshire, with its four electoral votes, doesn't weigh for that much. But at this point, it counts a lot, and these folks are very conscientious about how they use that power.
Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. John is calling from Windham, New Hampshire. Hello, John. Welcome.
Hi. I just want to make the point that I think John McCain's a classic example of why it works. He didn't have enough money coming out of the gates to be much of a threat, but in a state like this, he's able to get enough traction to make a name, and it appears to be working.
You're saying that because you like John McCain or because you like New Hampshire?
No, it's funny your screener asked me that. I like New Hampshire. I actually don't support John McCain, but it's an interesting laboratory experiment. You can make the same case for Bill Bradley, although he probably had a better shot in his race against Gore than McCain had with the dollar differential between he and Bush.
Will you say that, John, if George Bush wins the primary?
I still say that, because I think McCain's come so far that he's come from, at least in this area, a relative unknown, given, you know, his base in Arizona, to a very well-known. He's getting a lot of media attention. He's certainly in the race, and I don't think you could have said that 6 or 8 months ago.
John, thank you. Rick Burke, I mean, again, I look to you for the big picture. It's nice to hear people feel that New Hampshire is still distinctive.
Well, I think it certainly is distinctive now for all the reasons we've been talking about, but I think the big question after New Hampshire is, even if McCain wins or Bradley wins, what will it get them? Is it enough to give them what they need, the momentum, the support, to win in other states and to get the nomination? And that's still a big open question. We just don't know. So clearly, New Hampshire has not lost its importance early in the process. They're still all going there. There's a lot of intense campaigning and so forth. But ultimately, the impact of a win here, we just don't know.
Is there a good reason why Dan Quayle, or Liddy Dole for that matter, couldn't have done what John McCain is doing in New Hampshire? I mean, sort of, a relatively modest grassroots kind of personal campaigning.
Right. Well, you got to wonder if some of those other candidates that dropped out are kicking themselves now, because we have more big name candidates dropped out than are still in the race. A lot of that came after the straw poll in Iowa. But I don't know, you wonder about that. But the problem is, I think McCain was fortunate in the sense that the biggest threats to his candidacy dropped out, like Elizabeth Dole, who was fighting for some of the same turf, and some of the other big names dropped out. So I think that helped him stand out as the alternative to Governor Bush. So I think he was helped by that. Had Elizabeth Dole stayed in or Quayle stayed in, I don't know. They still might have all divided up the other-than-Bush vote.
1-800-423-8255, the New Hampshire primary connection. John is calling from Canterbury, New Hampshire.
Yes, hello.
Hello, John.
Good morning. I was curious as to Elizabeth Dole's move to support Bush. Recently, she just dropped, when she dropped out of the race, her concern was she didn't have enough money. And now she's endorsing the one candidate who is big money. Is she running for vice president?
Rick Burke, David Broder?
I think clearly the timing of her announcement was related to the fact that she doesn't want to be discounted as a vice presidential candidate. I think if she had waited too long, that would have hurt her prospects. Not that it's not clear to me that the Bush people would even consider her or not, but I think she came out for him at a time when he really needed a burst of support and help in New Hampshire. And I think if she had waited too long, she would have no prospect.
David Broder, Liddy Dole's endorsement of George Bush may be less important than Ted Kennedy's endorsement of Al Gore. Used to be when the Dunphy family owned that New Hampshire primary, a Kennedy endorsement was a very big deal. What does it matter today?
I'm not sure that endorsements mean that much in New Hampshire as they would in other states. I think, for example, Senator Chuck Grassley's endorsement of Bush yesterday in Iowa probably carries considerable weight there. But in New Hampshire, to go back to the basics, these folks have had so much exposure and will have so much personal exposure to the candidates that they make their own judgments. They're not waiting for somebody else to tell them what to do. You'll remember that 4 years ago, Steve Merrill, the governor of New Hampshire at the time and probably the most popular politician in the state, supported Bob Dole. Didn't get Dole nominated and didn't get him a victory in New Hampshire. I think these folks make their own judgments on their own basis of what they've seen and heard with their own eyes and ears.
Yeah, no, I think Pat Buchanan's prevailing against Steve Merrill and Bob Dole, I mean, it really told you the whole story of Dole's ultimately losing campaign, I think. But now the Democratic Party is a little bit different. I want you to just tell us, what does the Ted Kennedy endorsement of Al Gore mean?
I think it means one day's headlines, and then the rest of the campaign plays out very much as it would have before.
And if I may jump in, I think it would have been a more of a story, obviously, if Kennedy had endorsed Bradley, because Bradley is trying to establish himself as a candidate who people see has a real chance and could really win. And if you have the more and more big name figures in Washington that are not going along with the White House and the Gore bandwagon, I think would only help Bradley's cause. So I think that would have been a big story. Not that, as David said, not that endorsements in and of themselves mean that much, but if you see in the party establishment concern about a front runner, then I think that says something.
Guy McMillan, David Broder, Rick Burke, I'd like to ask you all to sort of approximate a sort of storyline about New Hampshire in the year 2000. 4 years ago, it did have a story, really, in Pat Buchanan's upset of Bob Dole, revealed Dole's weakness, but it also it brought that peasants with pitchforks notion of the shrinking of America jobs to the fore. It was reversed, of course, by the continued huge expansion of high technology and everything else, but it did give the country a kind of baseline story. What is the baseline story that's being written among these candidates in the year 2000? Guy McMillan, would you start us?
Boy, I don't know. I'll go back to the last one and just remind you that although Pat Buchanan did win the Republican primary, he won with 27% of the vote among Republican primary voters. It's a selected group, and it was a small number of people. I just say that as a New Hampshire resident. I try to uphold our honor here once in a while. This year, as you have said several times, there's no real ideological thing going on. The issue seems to be almost the primary itself. There's been so much talk about its face-to-face wisdom and all that, and I think we'll find out after February 1st whether the handshaking and the town hall meetings and all of the folklore surrounding the primary, which is all valid, whether that is what carries the day or whether the television commercials and the big money come in. We are pretty susceptible here to last-minute surprises in this state in pretty much any direction. So it's a little early to say what the story is. We'll know the story in about a month.
Rick Burke, do you see something about the country being told here in New Hampshire?
Well, I think the comparison with 4 and 8 years ago is striking, and what the voters are saying and what the candidates are saying, there's not the sadness and the unease among voters that we saw here in the past. I think the mood is different. I think it is different all over the country, and I think we're seeing that in New Hampshire. I think it's heartening in New Hampshire right now that we're seeing such a discussion, particularly on the Democratic side, of the issues and substance. And but I also think, as Guy said, I think the lessons ultimately from the race here. We just don't know until we have an outcome and until we see how that affects the rest of the race.
David Broder, what's the story here?
Chris, I think the story is very different from what it's been here in the past. If you ask yourself what has happened since the 1996 election that really has affected people's thinking, I think there are two things. One is this extraordinary prosperity that this region and the country are enjoying. The other is the continuing and growing disillusionment with politics and government as they witnessed it in Washington. They want to keep the prosperity going. They want to be sure that there's somebody competent in the White House, and that's why I think we found ourselves with four very mainstream, well-credentialed candidates emerging. Second, they want somebody who will give them an absolute ironclad guarantee that they will not be embarrassed in front of their children or see the country embarrassed in front of the world in the way in which it's been embarrassed by President Clinton during the last 4 years. They would like somebody who would have a chance to break the partisan stalemate in Washington. I'm not sure that they figured out yet who that person is.
David Broder, I think that's very, very close to the story, the way I feel it. I think it's important that we feel good about the New Hampshire primary again. We're not talking about a sort of angry, isolated and untypical part of the country. We're also talking about it as if it were a sort of four-way playoffs heading toward a World Series in which all the candidates are pretty good. They're all going to be different from Bill Clinton, praise God. I mean, they're all experienced. They're all talented. They're all somewhere near the center. They all know how to play the game. I think we all sort of feel not only that the economy is expanding, but there's talent in the country to do what has to be done. It's a generally pretty mellow, better than mellow moment, I think. Do you want a last word on that, Rick? Or
the only thing I would say is, there's all this upbeat talk, but just in defense of all these voters and elsewhere in the country, the reality is these candidates are catering to a very small group of voters, and it is still true that even with the earlier front loading of the earlier primaries, a lot of people will not have a say in who these nominees are.
That's true.
So I just to give everyone else a little bit of the other side of it.
Yeah, well, until we move a whole lot of voters up there, it's going to be that way.
No, thank you. It's okay.
We can take a hint, Guy. Last question. I mean, this may not be the most it may not even be the most exciting New Hampshire primary race that we've ever seen. Is it going to be as decisive in terms of picking a candidate, weeding the field, as any in the past? It sounds to me, Rick Burke, the way you write about it, as if it is.
I just don't know, because it all depends on what happens. I think it could be important. It could be, but look what happened 4 years ago with Buchanan. You know, he won and surprised everyone, but he broke tradition and not in winning New Hampshire and not winning the nomination. So we just don't know.
We will know, and thanks to you guys for helping us get ready for it. Guy McMillan at the Keene Sentinel, Rick Burke of the New York Times, David Broder of the Washington Post, thank you enormously. Thanks also to presidential candidate, the former senator from New Jersey, Bill Bradley, for joining us earlier in the hour. And thanks to all the callers from New Hampshire and elsewhere. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by PCs for Everyone, Windows 98, NT, and Linux-based computer systems and parts, building home PCs, corporate workstations, and servers, PCsForEveryone.com. And by Sunday River Ski Resort, featuring 8 interconnected mountains, 126 trails to explore, and an extensive snowmaking system, SundayRiver.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.